Hey everyone, I'm here with a very special guest, Crystal DeSantis, a licensed marriage and family therapist in Austin, Texas, who I connected with, my gosh, months ago, who has a real passion for men's mental health. And she's written a book, sent me a copy, Strong, okay, a relationship field guide for the modern man. And I am so excited to dive deeper today and hear how she wants to change just the entire narrative around men's mental health, especially in relationship. Welcome, Crystal. I'm so glad that we're finally chatting.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on here. I've been looking forward to this for a minute.
Yeah, same here. I mean, it's such a hot button topic, men's mental health. Men often hear, you know, go to therapy, get help. But what does that really look like? And you've decided to give an answer. It's actually several answers, but I really thank you for that. And I can't wait to hear about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the landscape of mental health in general has changed tremendously. I mean, even since I was in school and I got licensed. I mean, I got my provisional license. I graduated with my master's degree in marriage and family therapy back in 2014. And, you know, now we're in 2024, so 10 years later. And my gosh, you know, the field that I entered is not the field that it is today. And for that, you know, in some ways, it's really amazing to see all of the changes that have happened and how normalized going to therapy is and how much conversation there is about the importance of mental health for men and women, for couples, for everyone. And I still think, you know, part of why, like you said, why I wrote this book is because there is still a little bit of a gap in the field when it comes to men.
Right. No, there is. I think, and that's because there's a gap in what we expect from men. What model do we want to draw from? You go into some great detail at the outset of the book about how relationships have changed, right? They're not primarily for safety, security, procreation, all of those things. Mm-hmm. They're more optional in today's world. And so with that comes a difference in men's role versus they need to be out there providing, protecting against the elements and kind of that evolutionary psych model, and instead amp up some of the other skills that they have and that they might not be hearing about even that they have or that they're expected to develop. And so I'm really grateful you're giving some of that. You talk about those three traditional P's of masculinity, a protector, provider, and procreator, and you flip it and say, actually, a man who is optimally functioning now needs to foster trust, respect, openness, nurturing, generosity. So you give us those six things that are much richer than a lot of what's out there now for men, but they're still in line with healthy traditional masculinity. So that's the first thing that jumped out to me. Was there a moment you knew that you wanted to write this book and you were just like, that's it? Or was it a collection of smaller moments and you finally decided, I'm doing it?
So it was a collection of small, I never set out to write a book. I mean, that, again, it sounds really hard. I mean, I never thought I would do that. But what I noticed, again, was just this pattern. So I primarily work with couples, right? So my license is in marriage and family therapy. My degree is in marriage and family therapy. So I never intended to go in focusing on individuals. But one of the things I noticed as I was working with couples is this kind of same pattern over and over that, you know, the men were kind of struggling in comparison to their female partners. And again, you know, it wasn't every single couple I saw, but it really stuck out to me how much therapy and mental health and tools for mental health and wellness and mindfulness and relational skills was really heavily targeting women. And women were the main consumers of wellness stuff, mental health stuff. I mean, look at yoga, look at, you know, all of this stuff. It's very heavily dominated by women, the wellness industry.
Yes.
And so I was seeing these guys, like you said, they're coming in thinking they're doing, like, what am I not doing? I'm working hard. I'm trying to provide for my family. You know, I'm the traditional man, and why is my wife so unhappy? And so I was kind of having the same conversation over and over. And that's kind of when I was like, you know what, let me write a book. Because also there's that other barrier of getting men to come into therapy was also a hurdle, because there was so much mystery about, like, well, what am I going to do in there? Are these women just going to gang up on me and tell me that I'm the bad guy? Why would I pay for that? And so this was also kind of like hopefully making the process a little bit more transparent, at least in coming to work with me, of like, this is what I would, you know, these are the skills I will focus on, these are the tools I'll focus on, so you can feel a little bit more empowered coming into the therapy room. Kind of acknowledging that there is, you know, in some ways a little bit of a power imbalance when it comes to being a female dominated field, mm-hmm. right? And also just being a therapist, you know, there's that inherent power imbalance when it comes to working in, you know, with clients.
You nailed it. So I will jump in and say, with my male clients, a lot of them will come to me and I think they prefer working with a guy because either they're married and they think it's inappropriate to be that emotionally intimate with another woman. You can have, everybody can have their thoughts on that. And also just, they don't know what to expect. And I like what you're saying. I think the worst case scenario for couples therapy for a man is he goes in and he automatically is the bad guy. I mean, again, you're saying, why would you pay for that? Well, some men really can buy the narrative that they are the bad guy. And then that gets into a lot of shame and fuels that up, which is never good. But I think I see men who will come to therapy and think, well, I need to emote everything and I need to just get all my feelings out and that's it. And I think as someone who comes from a model of trauma-informed therapy, I know that people have to go at their own pace and sometimes slower is faster. And sometimes like with EMDR therapy, where you have people move through their memories, they don't have to speak every part of that memory if it's uncomfortable. They don't have to vocalize that. Going through and acknowledging it is often sufficient. And I wish more men knew that, that there is this caricature of therapy in media, the same as in other fields, where it's simplified into cry and feel better, emote and feel better. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's the process someone has, but it isn't for everyone. And also, we have models like acceptance and commitment therapy. We have behavioral activation therapy that are centered on developing your values, pursuing them, far more positive focused instead of what I would call the pity-based mental health pop culture model of, you know, it's okay to not be okay. I fully agree with that. I love that slogan, but it's also okay to try a little each day to feel okay. And I think we swing so far in culture, you know, women are bad this generation, men are bad the next. Like, you know, in this, let's lean heavily into negativity. Yeah, that's the starting point, but you don't have to say, well, that's just my anxiety or that's just who I am. It doesn't have to be. Therapy, good therapy that you are paying for, you should get your money's worth to learn how to do better. And I think when we lean to that narrative more, like you do in your book, of what to do, just not what not to do, then men are going to get a lot more on board because of their achievement focused narrative a lot of the time.
Totally. And that's part of what I wanted to validate, right? Is that, you know, it's not wrong to want a plan. It's not wrong to need structure. It's not wrong to ask for homework and tools so that you can practice. And so really kind of embracing that approach for myself as I started the work. And also, I think you bring up a really interesting point is because, you know, like you said, some men will prefer a male therapist because they're like, you know, I just want to kind of talk it out man to man.
Sure.
But I also have seen the other side where, you know, some men prefer a female therapist because they're like, well, I just don't feel comfortable being emotional around another man. Again, there's a lot of kind of assumptions, negative biases, myths about therapy and masculinity and about marriage in our field. And so I think, you know, part of writing this book was like, let's deconstruct some of that. Like,
yes.
What are we even doing here?
Yes. I love that. I love it. So was there anything that we haven't touched on that surprised you about researching this book, like that you found in your deep dive on men's issues, something that really stood out?
Yes. How little women know about men.
Ooh, say more. Let's do this.
So I came from a different culture. And so I grew up in Japan. And my dad is white American. And my mom is Asian. And I grew up in a completely different culture. And so when I came here to the States, I came here for college. And so I really was trying to figure out, you know, how do these people interact with each other? And actually, I moved to North Carolina. And so, you know, there was this very kind of Greek culture when it came to college of like, you know, there's the frats and the sororities. And so in some ways, I kind of got this, I don't know, deep dive into the, you know, masculine, feminine socialization in this American culture. And so I think I took that into my work. I also very much, after college, I ended up moving to California and living around a lot of military bases. You know, obviously, California has a lot of military families. And so, again, just kind of looking at this, in certain ways, these very like hyper-masculinized and then, you know, how they operate in this culture of the military. So I think all of that really kind of just informed the way that I learned about how men and women operate in this culture. And so as I was writing my book and doing the research and then talking to my colleagues and talking to friends or even bringing it into my work, I think, you know, one of the things that really stood out to me is sometimes in session, I would, you know, kind of be trying to explain to the female partner, like kind of what the male partner is saying.
Right.
And, you know, there would be this like, that's not a thing. Or he doesn't think that, do you? I'm like, these are like two totally different worlds here.
Yes.
And then doing the research for the book, I mean, obviously on the internet, like digging into some of the manosphere stuff, digging into some of the like, you know, feminism stuff. And I was like, wow, these echo chambers, and it goes both ways, but you know, speaking as a woman, that was one thing. I'm writing this book for men, and so much of the was like, women don't understand men. And of course, the opposite, right? Men don't understand women.
Oh, you know, I want to put you on the spot for a minute. Is there anything that you noticed that women just didn't get about men? So a common point about the male thought process?
So one is the debate thing. So in my book, and part of my couple's work is I talk about there are four positions of conversation. And honestly, I think this is the one that, it starts with kind of, I put position one is listening. Position two is joining. Position three is fixing. Position four is debating. And what I found, right, is that in a couple, the woman is generally starting with expecting listening and then joining, which is the empathy. And then, but the man kind of starts from the other side, right? He might start with either fixing or debating. And so being able to explain that, like, this is a bid for connection. He's trying to offer you something. Because again, if we go back to our society, men have been taught to lean into their utility very strongly as like, this is why you matter, is because you're useful. So if your wife tells you that she had a bad day, come on, buddy, what you got? Give her a fix. What are you going to do about it, right? Or again, if you don't know what to do about it, maybe you can't fix it, maybe then throw out some debate. Maybe try to like reframe it for her. Like, is it really that bad? Come on. And all of those things, again, if you look at that in the context of how men interact with each other, right? Men love sitting around, not all men, but, you know, there's this very much a culture of like men sitting around and debating with each other for the sake of intellectual stimulation or throwing ideas around or getting to know each other. I mean, that's really kind of like it's like butt sniffing, right? Like a little bit with dogs. It's like getting to know, like, where do you stand? What's, you know, it's like, you know, it's a male bonding thing. Right. And the same thing, like you fix, right, as a way to, you know, if the son calls dad and he's like, hey, dad, the car broke down. Dad doesn't say, oh, no, are you OK? He says,
how does that feel?
Yeah. He says, did you run out of gas? Like, what are you doing? Like, tell me the problem. What lights are on? Right. And so, again, just the difference in being able to reframe that and then helping both people. Right. Say like neither of these tools are wrong, right? It's not wrong to want listening. It's not wrong to be more of a debater, but being able to find the right tool for the conversation that you're currently in with the partner that you're with.
Yes. You know? You have to do some code switching. You have to change between how you interact with your bros, how you interact with your female partner. I mean, I think that's a huge stumbling block for a lot of guys. I've known people in my life who have more of that debating style of communication. And I think where they've struggled is in that being off-putting to people who don't mm-hmm. know that they enjoy a lively conversation. Someone has to know that you're not attacking them. You're not even attacking their ideas. You want to engage it in a lively debate. And I, that doesn't mm-hmm. always play well with romance. And mm-hmm. I think men need women in their lives, or men who are insightful about that fact, who are married or what have you, who can say like, hey, there are other ways to communicate that I think you'd be good at or think you could develop mm-hmm. some skill in. But I like what you're tying it into in, you know, men often in dating and in general will value ascending some hierarchy or having a competence or having a point that mm-hmm. around which is like their charisma is like gravitational pull. It needs an object. And so you develop this competency that's like a planet and you have this charisma around it because hollow charisma ends up leading nowhere. People sniff that out and figure you out after you've gotten what you want. And that's that kind of the narcissist path. Mm-hmm. It leaves a lot of pain, and a lot of disillusionment, but it's not wrong to develop competence and be able to give solutions and that be mm-hmm. a point of pride. And you talk about pride a lot, developing that for me in your mm-hmm. book, but you have to be able to say, well, that's for later. Maybe that teaching moment can come after that, that wellspring of emotion. And when she needs me to just listen and know that I'm here as a point mm-hmm. of connection. I think if mm-hmm. men got that and it clicks, that's going to change so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, in some ways too, like you said, I mean, it starts with developing that certainty and that confidence that you are somebody who is worthy of connection just as you are. You don't have to be, you know, and this is where I think, like we see in the internet culture of like, you know, the mansplainers, like, ugh, this guy yeah. just walked in and like told us his opinion, like nobody asked for that. And like, I've been on the receiving end of that and it is exhausting, right?
Yes.
But also then working with clients of like, but then what? How do I enter a conversation? Right? Like maybe not so much talking about the coupled clients, but, you know, the individual and like, well, then how do I enter the conversation if I'm not adding value in some way? It's like, well, what if you just showed up and said, hi, what are y'all talking about? Can I join? But again, that's a new paradigm for a lot of men.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And it's super vulnerable, right? Because they could say, no, thanks. We're good.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I think we have to look at what causes that, right? So you've got men who lean into the white knight element of their personality. And what do? You attract partners who have no space for your emotion. And so I wonder if you've seen this where when the guy decides it's time to open up, it kind of, if they're with a partner who's not there for that, who wants to be the emotional individual, like they're like, oh, I'm not, this isn't for me. Like, mm-hmm. I'm happy when you listen to me as a good mm-hmm. listener. Mm-hmm. But when it's you, like, I don't think I want that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this is where the tropes and the stereotypes hurt both men and
absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely.
Right? Because, and so this is part of where, you know, I wrote this book and it's for men.
Yeah.
You know, to balance out the field and balance out, you know, the resources out there. But in my practice, I very much emphasize, like, these are skills for any gender.
Yes.
Right? I don't care how you identify. You, in order to be a good partner, being able to utilize all of these skills is going to make you a better partner no matter, like, your orientation, your gender
right.
identity.
Right.
It doesn't matter. This is how to connect as a human being.
Absolutely. I mean, I would want to ask you, what do you think most modern women would want men to know at this point? We're talking a lot about the mismatch in communication. I know you don't speak for all women, but I thought this would be a good question.
So I think, and this is where also, yeah, like women are not a monolith, right? I think that there are a lot of, and so maybe this is the population I'm going to speak for, is that there are quite a lot of women that are rooting for men.
That's good to know.
There are. And I think there's another faction of women that have been rooting for men and then have felt like then they're doing all the work.
Mm.
Right?
That makes a lot of sense.
And then there are definitely women that are not rooting for men.
Sure.
Right? And they're like, screw them. Right?
due to whatever reason or trauma or things that intervene.
Exactly. And I would say the same on the opposite side.
I think so.
But that's really that faction I really want to focus on. And I almost put it in the disclaimer of my book of like, you know, if you believe like all men or all women, this book is probably not for you.
Right.
And if you have no interest in the struggles of the other gender, then also this book is probably not for you. Right.
Good point.
But I really do think, and this is what I want to focus on, is I think a lot of people are rooting for men. A lot of women are rooting for men. And I hope that men hear that. But again, that's kind of the rooting for you doesn't mean that you don't have to then do the work.
No, it doesn't. It means you've got a secure base, someone who is going to assume the best, who's going to have goodwill toward you and the ability to not jump at a mistake and assume it was your intention to do that. But it means that on that journey, there needs to be some progression on your part. I love that. It's a both and for sure.
Exactly.
I love that you made the point too on this exact topic that, you know, if we need a new masculinity that takes the best parts of masculine, you're asking men to change and not be masculine. You're asking them to channel that into new pathways and really return to, because you talk about nurture, I'm not getting too far ahead, but this idea that it's a new thing that men were not as involved in children's lives actually since the Industrial Revolution. It's not the old way, like in farmsteading and all the different things. I love that you take the best parts of masculinity and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that you say, if we want something new for men, we got to support them and we got to reinforce that. I think that message is definitely needed and is a unique feature of your book for sure.
Yeah. Ooh, I guess then I would add the other thing is that maybe, again, I'm not speaking for all women, but, you know, as a straight woman, masculinity is very attractive. Right? And so, but I think, and this is why I kind of use, I don't like the word toxic masculinity, but like restrictive or rigid or you know, immature masculinity. It's like, Those are the expressions of masculinity that are not attractive to women. But like a full, mature, grounded, masculine presence is incredibly attractive. And I don't even need to throw sexuality in there. It's just, it's a powerful presence, right?
Right.
And so I think, you know, really this whole idea that like, oh, you know, feminists don't like masculinity. They want men to become women. It's like, actually, you know, that's not how nature works, right? You can't just say like, nighttime is stupid. Winter is stupid. Let's get rid of it. Well, guess what? Global warming, it sucks.
You know? Let's get rid of all that. Right.
You know? And so I think being able to recognize that like nature is always about balance. It's always about integration. Any mature system has more complexity than it has, you know, it's not binary.
Right.
And so really having more admiration and there are a lot of women that really, really enjoy and crave that healthy, mature, masculine presence. But, you know, it's gotten really confusing in the tropes of masculinity. You know?
Yes, meaning there's so many of them. There's kind of a double bind of what men are expect, like update it, but keep it classic. Different conflicting messages.
Yeah.
I love that. I would throw in now, this is probably a good time to go over what each of those letters mean in your book, because I know we've chatted and you really enjoy the elements of that safety part, the S in strong.
Yes.
And I'm thinking we dive in there, like what inspired that, like what you're passionate about on men cultivating a masculine sense of safety.
Yeah. I think because, you know, when I talked about, or when I was looking at the research of like how men kind of think of masculinity, it's like the protector and the provider, right? And so both of those things kind of fall under the umbrella of like safe, right? I keep my family safe. I keep my family, you know, housed and clothed, and I fight away anybody who comes to try to hurt them, right? So I keep them safe. But again, like, I talk about in the book, like, you don't, like, how do we evolve that? How do we then take it into the next iteration of being a protector and provider, but keeping that element of, as a man, I want to make my partner feel safe. Okay. Yeah. So let's break that down. And so that's really where I, and also, like you said, as a trauma-informed professional in this work, there's nothing without safety when it comes to human relationships. Let's, you know, or any, actually, even animal relationships, right? It's like, yeah, safety is fundamental. It's a biological imperative,
yeah,
to be safe.
It is. And so when you look at people who have been through trauma and they can be triggered by feelings of unsafety, like men who don't have the emotional vocabulary or the awareness that maybe they're feeling frightened or threatened in some way, and that's coming out as anger or some other form of behavior, like running from a situation, mm-hmm, right? That flight response, it might not be fight, being able to get in touch with that nervous system. I mean, you talk about it. You talk about self-regulation and self-expression, mm-hmm, and those being key, mm-hmm, to, yeah, developing that safety. Yeah. And there's, like, EMDR, there's so many different therapies can deal with that in a non-stigmatizing way.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And then the first, so the four S's of safety. So the first one is self-awareness, which, again, you know, I think it's just a basic, being a good person in a relationship, having some basic self-awareness. Why do you do the things you do? What are you pursuing? What's important to you in life? And how does that affect people around you? I think just that basic piece of self-awareness is also about just existing in a society.
Yes.
But also, like you mentioned before, you know, the idea that you have to be in a relationship is no longer a social obligation.
Right.
Right. And so that self-awareness, yeah, of, do I actually even care about being in a relationship right now? Or are there other things that I would rather pursue with my time? Maybe I want to, I don't know, focus on my career. Am I allowed to do that? Absolutely. You know, but then be honest about that and don't half-ass a relationship at the same time. Right.
Right.
Because then you're probably going to hurt your partner and, you know, end up in one of those bad relationships. So that self-awareness piece is number one in showing up safely and grounded in your relationship, right? I know why I'm here. I know what I bring to the table. I know what my triggers are. I am self-aware as I enter this relationship. And the second one is stability, basic skills of stability, which, you know, again, kind of, maybe it's a boring trope, but it shows up a lot in relationships, right? Of what's the saying? Girls are raised to be wives, men are not raised to be husbands, right? Yeah. Of the kind of emphasis on, you know, cleaning and cooking and raising children is kind of the expectation. And there are, of course, lots of books and lots of resources about, you know, why do women get the, you know, even though they're making the same amount of money, they still have the most, you know, the bulk of the childcare, the cooking and the cleaning and the scheduling, sure, and the talking to the teachers and the appointments and blah, blah, blah. And so that's also where then for men being able to emphasize, like, this is not a lady thing that ladies are born with. These are skills that you can also learn to develop so that you can show up and help co-create a stable environment for your family and your children. Because this is also where I see contempt show up a lot in couples. Right. Yeah. So if the woman or the mom, and she's like, God, you know, this husband I have, like, I love him or I want to love him, but he makes it so hard because he, you know, can't figure out, like, how to dress the kids or take them, right, to school. Like, I can't rely on him. And so then it erodes that, do I really feel protected by him? Or is he at this point kind of a nuisance?
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Which, and also doesn't do anything for his self-esteem, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you don't want to be that guy that, I don't know, can't cook his own meal, you know, or his mom has to come help him out when, you know, because he can't be left alone with his own children. I mean, also, if you think about that, that's fairly, you know, infantilizing. And there are, yeah, you know, like, my husband, don't worry, like, I'm leaving him in town with the kids, but, you know, my mom's coming in to help him. It's like, well, is he is he capable of being a parent or not? And if not, like, why, like, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're getting to a larger point that's just so crucial of, and I'm going to say this, like, the unsexy, unromantic conversations are important. So you meet someone in college or in high school or at a church group and you court them, you've got the narratives there that you need to get married. And if you're, and that's great if you, you really know what that means.
Yeah.
If you don't, and it's just what you do, which are four dangerous words, just what you do. Like, I've seen that be the pathway to hell.
Absolutely.
Where it's like, oh, this is what being married is like. Oh, this is what having kids is like. Well, that's not for me. It's like, whoa, but those were big decisions, right? So along the way, I mean, people with romance, it seems, go into the infatuation, beautiful stage, and you don't want to think about the unsexy stuff of, are we really compatible with what we expect, and the logistical stuff. And I get that. That's not poetic or romantic or sweeping you off your feet. But what happens after you've been swept off your feet? What happens with your narratives around child rearing that you don't explore? Is that can turn into massive, as you said, contempt, love that word, resentment. And it's crucial that couples understand that. And even while you're single, that's a great time to do that, when you're really able to be objective and not think, oh, I'll do it for this person, or dangerously, they'll do it for me, he'll change. Again, two horrifying words.
Exactly. You know, and some of that, again, goes back to kind of that self-respect aspect when it comes to masculinity, right? Because part of, in this, you know, it's really interesting, because part of, like, one of the kind of ways that men feel their masculinity is by feeling capable.
Yes.
Right? So, but so then kind of calling that also into self-accountability, right? Of like, if you then present as incapable in your relationship simply because you haven't taken the time to learn or try, like, that's also negatively impacting your own self-image.
It is.
And it is really, it's, you know, then the emotional labor gets dumped on the wife, or the physical labor, or all that stuff. And it's just a really bad recipe when it comes to, you know, fulfilling healthy relationships. You need two stable adults.
Yeah.
Being in a marriage or a long-term relationship is hard work. Like, let's start with basic life skills. Can both of you do laundry? Do both of you know what a budget is, right? Yeah. So
it is crucial. And I love that you talk about personhood or performance, that in that safety chapter, that men need to understand their basis for being wanted and not just needed, because they usually learn the latter, to be needed. And so, and that's no more relevant today. I mean, that is the most relevant thing today. Never has it been more relevant to see that people aren't just capital or assets to be swiped on and chosen at whim. If you feel that way, that's really dehumanizing. And if a guy feels that he has to be on at work, or that's that performance element, he might switch that off and not view doing household tasks or being involved at home as part of his personhood. He might have a limited, it's very stressful to perform constantly. And imagine the stress of that versus saying, okay, well, I'm going to do these things out of my values, or just learn a bit at a time and not feel the pressure to have to do it immediately, or feel that shame that I'm incompetent. It's not an all or nothing. It can be gradual. I think many men struggle with that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Of
gradual change. Many people do, but especially men. Like, I'm either going to be right at it and I'm going to kick butt, or that's it, not doing it.
Yeah. And honestly, that's something that, you know, I really enjoy talking about, not just with male clients, but specifically, is the idea of self-compassion.
Yes.
You know, and I talk about it in the book of, again, this is not just sitting around throwing yourself a pity party and making excuses and feeling sorry for yourself, but it really is about acknowledging that, especially if you are coming to therapy for the first time or working on your marriage for the first time, I mean, you have to be gentle with yourself, because you're not going to be an expert overnight. That's just not how anything works. You have to learn. And part of learning is sometimes getting it wrong. Sometimes, you know, one step forward, two steps forward, one step back, right? It's this, you know, and so having the compassion with yourself that as long as you keep showing up, you're doing the work.
Love that. That's a great mic drop moment. It's, there has to be a space for seeing yourself as in process and mm-hmm. not that you've just reached manhood and you can only lose footing and lose what you have from there. There's much to gain too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I love the trust. Were you going to say something else?
Oh, no, just, yeah.
I love the trust part as well. You have a lot of different things to repay. Like you have that repair acronym. Where do you want to dive in on that? What do you think men should know about cultivating trust in relationships and what they should look for their trust to be earned as well?
Absolutely. And I think that is one of the, maybe one of the highlights that I did want to put in there is trust is a two-way street. You cannot build it one way.
No.
Right? It is a dynamic process of call and response. When I call, you respond. When you call, I respond, right? This is where the building blocks of the relationship, you know, first that safety piece, like you have to have like a good like plot of land. But yeah. Then starting with trust is really where then that foundation of the relationship gets built. And I like to talk about building trust as like kind of the, you know, like the strings of a suspension bridge. It's like, you know, when you see the Golden Gate Bridge or some massive suspension bridge, it started with one little cable, you know, one little cable. And then you just keep going, right? And so I think that's something else is trust is a process and there has to be somebody on the other side to throw the cable back. So yeah, don't build trust with an untrustworthy person by saying, it's fine, I got it. I'll do all the work, you just stay right there. Because I also see that, like you said, I mean, I've seen it with women, I see it with men, where I'm like, let's talk about how reciprocal this relationship is. And like, you really want, and I talk about in the book, the difference between believing someone and actually building trust with them.
Love that.
Right? Where it's like, oh, I know they're a good person. Oh, but I know she loves me. It's like, yeah, but when does she show up for you? Right? And like how many times that you've believed in her and she's like not done anything with that. She hasn't done anything to earn your trust.
Yes.
You know?
What happens when the rubber meets the road? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think projection and expectations wreak havoc in these relationships. So you have people who maybe are attracted to someone or that person physically or that other person embodies some sort of attributes that other person admires. And so you have the willing ignorance of like, well, I want this person. And so like unconsciously, I'm going to ignore these other elements where my needs aren't being met because it's intoxicating to be around them. It's like mm-hmm. full stop. That is not a foundation for success. And that's an understatement. And
yeah.
I've seen online different narratives where it's a red flag. If you're attracted to someone, that was something that went viral on Twitter weeks ago. And people had mm-hmm. a field day saying that's completely false. But I think that idea is a massive overgeneralization of this idea that you need to be careful if all you're going on is your butterflies. I do agree mm-hmm. with that. I think you need to be careful mm-hmm. if that's all, because mm-hmm. how much are you fantasy, like you're world building like an author, you're fantasy building, and there's mm-hmm. no real evidence that this person is right for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like to kind of just say like, chemistry is not compatibility.
Oh, that's genius. You know? I love it. That's quotable. Yes.
These are two distinct categories, you know?
Yeah.
But also with the idea of earning trust or building trust mm-hmm. and doing it like a bridge and like the cables that, you know, continue is that if one of them ruptures, that doesn't mean the whole thing is broken, right?
No, right.
But you do have to be careful of if somebody's like setting fire to the other end, right?
Yeah. Serial lying, cheating.
Yes.
Obviously big, big, big red flag parades. Mm-hmm. But I think you hit on something there. People just intoxicate themselves and poison themselves with TikTok and Instagram videos about, well, like relationship expectations and things. And it's so black and white. I don't think we've ever been in an era of more black and white thinking. I don't know if you agree with me.
Yeah. And that's part of, again, where I think binaries, black and white thinkings is never a sign of maturity or intelligence. And again, I don't mean that like as people specifically, I'm not calling specific people out, but I'm talking about systems, right? The more complex a system is, the more mature, it's going to be so much more nuanced.
Yes.
Right? It's like, this is where the Dunning-Kruger effect comes in, right? It's like people that know just a little bit, they think it's so easy to say, yes, no, black, white, here's your answer. And the more you know, you realize, oh, it's really not that simple. There's confounding factors. There are exceptions to the rule. There are, you know, like it's a multi-layered process. And so I think, you know, being careful about, but I also think it's a very human thing, especially right now with maybe the oversaturation of information, is that people also are tired. And they're like, just give me it straight. Like, I don't have maybe the time to do the critical thinking. Just tell me, like, is this person a green flag or a red flag? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm exhausted. Just, you know, tell me what the right thing to do is. And again, that's, I see that as a removal of agency. And I am always about, like, as a therapist, I'm always about, like, no, retaining your agency in your relationship, showing up, it helps you show up empowered, which helps you show up strong, right? And so that's why I love that word. Like, I believe in strong people and strong men and strong women.
Yeah.
You don't need to shrink yourself to be in a relationship.
No. No, I love that. It's very, very in line with the masculine spirit. I love that. Okay. I want to say also, I love the respect element to the R in strong. Mm. I think Nancy McWilliams, the psychoanalytic theorist and author, I remember going to a lecture on hers about narcissism, and she talked about that we have so much about empathy in the mental health field, but not a lot about respect. And that goes to your point that a lot of it's not phrased in masculine language. Empathy is great, but men thrive often not just really on being heard, but on being respected and seen as worthwhile, right? Mm-hmm. It's encoded in masculine narratives. I think there's probably a biological element too, but I'd love to talk about that, on what inspired you to tackle that topic of respect.
Mm. Yeah, I think because, you know, part of in paying attention to men's needs in the therapy space, that was something that you said, it was very apparent that feeling respected was very, very closely correlated to feeling loved in the relationship. And so one of the things that I kind of also kind of parsed out when it came to respect is, are you asking for respect of your autonomy, your agency, your personhood? Or are you asking for respect of your authority?
Mm, brilliant.
And so really, again, like, you are 100% having your agency, having your autonomy, having your body boundaries, having your boundaries of who you are as a person, all of those respected in a healthy relationship, 100%. Healthy, healthy, healthy. Demanding respect for your authority just because, it's kind of like the parent that's like, because I'm bigger than you. And you're like,
right.
Well, right. Yeah, no wonder the kid's disrespectful and pushing back, right? Because that's not a very strong argument.
And it's not also, too petty either.
Yeah. And also in a couple, like, is this actually implicit or is this an explicit agreement that you are the boss? Like, are you the head here? If not, then, and again, like, is there, I mean, again, redefining, like, is it more egalitarian or is there an actual, I am the last word here? But then if not, then no wonder you're having so much trouble asserting your authority and demanding respect, because, you know, it's like the guy that yells at, I don't know, the person at McDonald's and it's like, I demand, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, you don't have any power here, dude.
Right.
Like,
come on. Yeah.
You know? And so really kind of correlating, like, respect of personal power, internal power, or are you trying to demand respect by taking power over somebody who is actively resisting that from you? Mm-hmm. And then you feel disrespected, but, you know, you're going about it in an unhealthy way.
I agree. And I think people have to be aware of their own nervous systems. What is the reason you're trying to take this control and power? Is it to avoid the painful sensations of feeling rejected or feeling someone's not listening? And you learn to deal with that by just yelling louder and by throwing down more ultimatums. Like, what drives that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes back to that vulnerability piece, right? Of like, you know, what if you don't actually have any power over, then you just have to rely on maybe I have to trust that my partner actually respects me and my needs. And maybe she actually cares about meeting them.
Yeah.
And again, that's not the case for all couples, which no. is also something to, yeah, figure out.
It is something to determine. And again, I think it's so important to look at this stuff early on. So anyone who is wanting to date or develop a good relationship, it's really important to early on think about this stuff. Again, it's not romantic, but it could save your relationship and enable all of the romance and nice fuzzy feelings that you're seeking. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
love that you talk about boundaries in that mm-hmm. chapter about respect and avoiding the trap, the similarity trap. Specifically assumption of similarity, meaning that you and your partner think the same way.
Yeah.
Think that's crucial. Get to know how your partner thinks in different moods as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Respect the differences, you know.
And the fact that you talk about developing your own values and you have a value sort, like a page with all of that. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think we're told that. I know we're not really told that anymore outside of religious traditions or other venues, like what do you stand for? What do you value? Do you value wisdom? I mean, that's such a foreign conversation to people. You kind of pick up what's in the culture and see what feels good mm-hmm. and sticks. And I like that mm-hmm. you're saying, no, wait a minute, develop your masculine virtues and have that be what your self-respect flows from. What inspired you for that?
You know, again, I feel like that's where self-respect and actual healthy respect starts from the inside, right? It's like when yes. you know and you respect yourself, then it's up to you to conduct yourself in alignment with your own values. And when you do that, you are a better person in the world, but also it's much easier for you to distinguish disrespect from someone else and not like feel, I guess, compelled to engage in a power struggle with that person.
Yes. You know? Love that. Brilliant.
So.
And with your openness chapter, you talk about a few things that I found pretty interesting. So in cultivating that openness, you discuss this idea of the Alexander the Great point. Mm-hmm. So obviously him being that. Yeah, that was a great metaphor. He felt there was nothing left to conquer in a relationship. Mm-hmm. Can you speak more about that and monotony and just falling into routine?
Totally. And it's really interesting because, you know, I think the maybe stereotype or the trope of the midlife crisis, right? You know, the guy that wakes up and he's 40 and he's like, holy crap, my life is so boring. I'm going to go do something wild. You know, yeah. And then he ends up, you know, and again, this is kind of the old trope, right? Then he ends up running away with his secretary, buying a sports car and leaving his family in the dust. But if you look at it in like this is a reaction to feeling so rigid, feeling so confined, feeling so kind of following a script for your life that doesn't leave any room for you to be a person, for you to grow. It's like, I'm just going to show up and do the same thing over and over until I die. Screw that. Right. Yeah. And so again, this midlife crisis of like at some point in life, having that realization that I want more openness. I want more experiences. And so again, embracing that into a healthy relationship. You don't have to leave your healthy relationship to go get adventure. In a healthy relationship, that's built in. As long as you're both open to the reality that you're going to be different people in 50 years than you are today.
Yes.
But if you're going to plan to be with the same person in 50 years, there's got to be some conversations about how you're each changing yes. and developing as individuals. And then what does that mean for your couple, right? Mm-hmm. The growth mindset.
Yes, you have to be willing to take that on. It's not a done deal. Marriage is just the beginning, really. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the villain on the couch.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love that term. It's so potent.
It really is. Again, this is what happens when people end up getting married and forget to update each other on who they are.
Yes.
Is, you know, our minds also have a negative bias, right? So over time, what I saw is couples coming in and having a negative view of who their partner was. And again, I'm, you know, the sample size is couples that are in trouble, right?
Sure. Sure.
But this is one of those things of like, why are these couples in trouble? Well, it's because they have this image of who their partner is, that, you know, this partner is rigid and boring and not interesting. And, you know, I've already heard that story 1,000 times. And, you know, they never want me to have fun. And so all of these like scripts that they have. And then, you know, so part of my therapeutic style is kind of using humor of like, wow, you know, so this is a real villain on this couch next to you. But because all the stories you're saying is like, this person doesn't want you to have any fun. They don't want you to grow. They don't care about your needs. They're right. not willing to, you know, help you out in any way. They're not here to make your life easier. They're just tell you, they're here to tell you, like, I mean, a couple of things, right? Is there, and obviously this is not a therapy thing, but, you know, as therapists, sure. we could go through all of the assessments that we would have to do. But if it's just, I've only then over-focused on the negative aspects of who my partner is, and I've forgotten that, you know, maybe they're a dynamic human being, and I instead have painted them into this villainous caricature.
Yeah.
It doesn't give them enough, it doesn't give them any room to grow or evolve.
Right. No, it doesn't. And I think people can, it's, they could benefit quite a bit from that narrative therapy perspective that the person isn't the problem, the problem is the problem. How can we align mm-hmm. with that? How can we align exactly. to deal with the freeze response or mm-hmm. him leaving during an argument or her doing that or her mm-hmm. nagging and understanding, well, what can we do to alleviate the problem at its source of changing the way we interact or the behavior so that that doesn't emerge?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's kind of like what Brené Brown talks about, of being able to name it as the story I'm telling myself about this is.
Yes.
Right? That my yeah. partner is a villain and doesn't want me to be happy. Okay. Now there's a premise that we can challenge. Is that true? Right?
Right. Absolutely. Looking at it creatively. So we've talked about, I mean, we've talked about the importance of this stuff. I found it interesting in that chapter on openness that you discuss the gray wave of divorce. And I'm wondering if you have any attributions for that or thoughts on that trend.
You know, I talk about the two types of relationships, like function-based transactional relationships, which really don't require openness because they're about fulfilling a function. And so, you know, there might've been some gray divorces that were simply, you know, people that got together because they both wanted children. They, you know, maybe had some kind of social maneuvering to like, okay, you come from the same town, you're in the same age, you go to the same, sure. it's your high school sweetheart, your college sweetheart, whatever. And so then once the transaction or the function has been fulfilled, their kids are gone, they're out of school, they no longer have anything in common. And so the relationship right. is done, right? Or there are relationships that are based on connection and the intrinsic values of the individuals. And so those are, I think, the relationships that survive throughout the years. But it is very common, you know, when I was working with people that were on the brink of divorce, and I'm like, gosh, but you've been married for, you know, decades. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, we don't have anything in common anymore.
Right. It's heartbreaking. So developing those commonalities is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
On the nurturing part of Strong, the end, I really appreciate that you brought up that male loneliness epidemic. And I mean, 1/5 of men do not have close friendships. That's a 2021 study from the survey mm-hmm. Center on American yeah. Life. I mean, that says a lot. This says a lot about men needing to band together and be more open to male friendships and dedicate some energy there. And if they tend to just look to girlfriends or the potential of a girlfriend for their social life, that's a very loose proposition. You said a lot there. I want to thank you for bringing up in those three P's of connection, pride, pain, and pleasure. Pride. You're not saying that men can't be proud of their achievements or things that are ambitious, but instead you're saying that provider is not the only role. It can be proud of many things.
Absolutely. And if anything, I think, you know, pride is super healthy because it can also be used as a point for connection.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's also the other thing is that I've, you know, lots of, I've had these conversations where men are like, well, I want to nurture my connections with my partner or with my friends, but like, I don't know what to say. Like, I don't know how to take it from, hey, how was the game? Or how was your weekend? Or how was your day? To yeah. get to that next level. And so that's why I kind of developed the three P's of like, well, here are three points of connection that you can check in about. Because, you know, asking somebody, hey, what are you proud of this week? You know, you can ask your friend that, like, hey, buddy, like, what you been up to since the last time I saw you? What, give me a win so I can celebrate you. Yes. Right? And the same thing with your partner, being able to validate that, gosh, I'm really proud of you. I mean, that it's so simple, but it's so powerful when it comes to validating the connection of like, I'm not just like, oh yeah, thanks for bringing home a paycheck. It's I'm hearing that you're proud of yourself for something. I get to hear about that. And then I also get to celebrate you and cheer you on, right? What, yeah. And whatever it is, whether it's, you know, I was really clever in solving that problem. I don't know, invented it, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could go all of the ways.
Yes. All the ways. I completely agree with that. I think also looking at what your conversations are about, the pain that you're going through, how open you can be mm-hmm. on that, mm-hmm. maybe letting that out a little at times, you have issues with trust and vulnerability. Cause I think yeah. it's tough to expect men who have been told to take it on the chin and not talk about themselves to just immediately open up to all that stuff. And I like mm-hmm. that you realize that.
Yeah. And again, that like you said, kind of normalizing that pain mm-hmm. is part of the human experience. Yes. So trusting that if somebody is your friend, you can share real life stuff, and that might include pain, right? It might also include pride. You might, you know, again, so pride, pain, and pleasure. These are my three P's that I'm like, I think they kind of like do the little heartbeat of the human experience, like yeah. the up, down, the connect, right. the up, down, the connect, you know?
You're totally right about that.
Yeah. So
up, down, connect. I like that. It's the variance, the variability in the human experience. So getting to mm-hmm. G, that element, that final letter in strong, mm-hmm. I'm really happy that you add the cliches of happy wife, happy life, and the importance of men being generous in ways that are safe,
mm-hmm.
And on developing themselves as a person, professional, and partner / parent, if that's applicable.
Mm-hmm.
Feel free to say more about that and that whole spectrum of self model.
Yeah, I think because that's, again, going to, you know, a lot of men were raised in traditional culture, right? That it's happy wife, happy life. If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody going to get sleep tonight, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of these men were, what I was noticing is, you know, giving from a very empty place. So then in kind of maybe trying to find balance, then acting in ways that were then very selfish to kind of like make up for it, right?
Yeah.
And so again, just recognizing that like you cannot be all or nothing. You cannot be a giver, 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 giver all the time, because that's just not how humans work. There's going to be a snapback. You're not like I sometimes use the analogy of a rubber band. Like you can only give so much and then there's a snapback. And that snapback behavior might be the really selfish behavior that then hurts yourself, hurts your family. So let's get off the seesaw of like, but yeah. I have to give, I'm supposed to give. And it's like, you cannot give if you are starving. You cannot be generous when from a place of lack. Generous is an abundance. So you have to start with giving yourself that generosity. And again, of course, you know, going back to the self-care for men, what is it? What is even that, right?
What is it?
But that, you know, what does it look like to be generous with yourself? And it might be, you know, getting that gym membership that you've been talking about getting, or, you know, signing up for that, I don't know, nutritionist, or giving yourself that little, whatever it is that makes you feel a little bit like more full internally, yeah. because then you are giving from a place of true generosity, not from like, I'm obligated to do this, or in some ways I'm expecting a return on this investment. Right? That's not generosity.
No, it's not. You have to feel yourself first. And really, self-compassion and self-care have become so cliched. They can look like a lot. They can look active. We have this narrative of it being somehow more effeminate and about luxury. Pedicures. That's right. Yeah. What do you call it?
I don't know. It's like the pedicure version of wellness, right? Like pampering.
But and I think it's just a really an important way of looking at it is anything that rejuvenates you and helps you connect to your values and meaning and gets you back in touch mm-hmm. with a feeling of contentedness mm-hmm. and care. Yeah. So what does that for yourself and others, what is it that pulls you back into your mission? Like the Vikings mm-hmm. celebrating in the Mead Hall, like it can be in consolidating your energy, talking about conquest and battle, so many different metaphors that mm-hmm. people can think of besides just a pedicure. And I mean, mm-hmm. I thought there's nothing wrong with that. It's just interesting. Psychology starters kind of a very predominated by older white males or in European sort of sensibility. And I think we have to get this whole spectrum of, well, now it's definitely not viewed that way. And what are some new ways that men can fit into this? So I love mm-hmm. you getting into that. Like build yourself up first. Don't just try to get out there and, you know, date or do something mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. when you're hollow and you don't know who you are.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think kind of going back to, you know, for daters, going into the dating place from a empowered position of like, you know, I have a great life. I have all the skills I need to take care of myself, to, you know, to be emotionally healthy. I've got a great group of friends. Like, you know, self-care could also be hanging out with your friends and having a deep, you know, fulfilling conversation.
Yes.
Being able to enter into the dating space from there, because let's be honest, dating can be very draining emotionally. It also will give you that resilience, right? When you come into it already full, you're a little bit more resilient to the like expected knocks and bumps that are going to come along the dating path, right? If you're coming into it already kind of fragile because you're like fairly empty, it's just going to take one little knock and your self-esteem is going to be in the trash, right?
100%. Yes. Yeah.
So I think that's also where it goes to guys in relationships, not completely disappearing into what does my wife want from me? And then also for people that are dating, being able to come in to the dating sphere from a really strong and empowered position of like, I know what I have to offer and I'm not desperately just going to jump on the first person that says yes to me because I know my worth.
Right.
You know? And I can,
Go ahead.
Well, then I can be generous from a place of not trying to perform, not trying to impress, not being like, oh my God, please pick me. Like here, I'll give you all these gifts so you can choose, you know, I'm so generous. And it's like, no, that stuff is unfulfilling. It's fake. And it's not actually going to get you where you want to go, which is, you know, a healthy relationship or feeling valued for being who you are.
No, it's not. And I love this because this is a good segue to ask what you think about men who are trying to date and what they should do beforehand. You've given a lot here. Really strong can be a whole model for what to mm-hmm. do beforehand, just the parts that are self-development focused. But mm-hmm. I want to tag on when we were talking about points of pride. I think that men could benefit from not viewing their jobs as boring. Like if they do a job they find boring, find a way to talk about your pride point. Even if you do something that's very abstract or accounting or computer stuff, there's ways to talk about an achievement that you made and a pride mm-hmm. point. Instead of saying, oh, what I do is boring. I mean, that's kind of a conversation killer. So mm-hmm. I hear that a lot. It's like, oh, I don't even want to talk about what I do. Well, what else do you do? If you don't have any hobbies, you're sunk as far as what to talk mm-hmm. about, except the woman, except her. And it's kind of unattractive to have your own personality, to not have your own personality.
I mean. Exactly. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's interesting because also coming from a different culture, mm-hmm. You know, it is so interesting how cultural norms are different in different countries. And it's like maybe something I've found in American culture is people ask, like, what do you do? Yes. Very, very soon. And because it's almost like that defining of who you are. And so, again, like you said, being able to be more of a well-rounded individual so that your job is not all of who you are.
Right.
So, yeah, just in case, like, you have a job that you're not thrilled about, you can have something else to fall back on. Like, you know, I don't know, I'm a bass player. I have a pickleball team. I do this for work, but, you know, it's maybe the least interesting thing about me right now because I've got all this other stuff going on.
Yep.
Right?
And I think we can pull in and say, well, getting to know same gender friends as guys and having hobbies and things that you can do and kind of bouncing ideas off each other and under like conversing, getting practice in conversation can be very appealing as well. And learning, again, it all goes back to knowing your values, what makes you tick, what you're good at, so that you can have that to pull from in conversation and not just that you're a nice guy. That's where the nice guys go wrong, I think, is what else are you?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because that, again, that's leading with the, but I can make your life better. It's like, well, but why would I join your life? You know?
You got going on over there versus what you can bring over here. Yeah, no, I love that. That's perfect.
And I think, again, just caveat, right? Not every woman is by inherent virtue of her gender, a healthy person, right? No. And so I think that's also the thing is like, you know, when you can recognize, you know, your inherent worth, it also very much gives you the edge of being able to very quickly weed out unhealthy partners that are looking to objectify you, that are simply looking to profit off of, you know, whatever, like, oh, you want to make my life better? I'm in. You know? So I think that's also something. It goes both ways. Like when you're a healthier person, unhealthy people are not attractive to you. So you won't, again, you won't waste any of your time like trying to vie for an unhealthy person's attention. And, you know, you'll feel better when you engage because you will kind of raise the level of play.
Yeah. Love that. And I love the pizza of wellness. I mean, talk about a masculine friendly metaphor for optimizing your mental health. You've got family, spiritual, mental, intellectual, career, environmental, physical, and social as the aspects of health on there. So I think that's where men can get better, like improve all these different things in your life before looking for a relationship. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah. And when you're
in a relationship.
And that's the thing, like the goal, you don't have to be a perfect person.
Right.
But having some kind of framework that you can then kind of hold yourself into accountability so that your partner doesn't become, you know, and this part of why I have the compass on there, right? It's like, don't make your partner your North Star. Like you need your own so that together you guys can like chart a path. But you're not overly reliant on the relationship or your job to like define your identity.
Okay. I got you. That's really helpful. I think it's not what we hear. I mean, for men and women, you think of how you're not told like be a complete person beforehand. I think that's for convenience. I mean, I think dating apps would get a lot fewer subscribers if people realize what all was necessary for a relationship, right? That'd be a business killer. But it would be a hugely different world out there of relationships with better prognoses and statistics on togetherness and marriage retention. So, well, this is awesome, Crystal. I really appreciate the conversation today. I know our listeners and viewers can find you at ATX Therapist, which is an awesome username for Instagram. Any closing thoughts that you would want to leave us with, apart from getting your book, because I think people would really benefit from reading it. It's great.
Thank you. I guess, you know, I always want to end on hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's hope out there for anybody, no matter what your history is, no matter what, you know, your relationship background is, and, you know, especially I think for people that maybe are like, man, I've just had such a bad string of relationships, or maybe I've never been in a relationship. Like, is there hope for me? Maybe I'm, you know, somebody who's never quite kind of gotten it. It's like, you know, I always like, where there's life, there's hope, right? So, you know, kind of, and then also there's the Chinese, I think it's an urban legend, I don't know. But it's like luck is when preparation meets opportunity. You can't control the opportunity piece, but you can control the preparation piece. And that to me is that kind of like, I live in hope, is because I'm still preparing. Right? Don't give up on yourself. Keep hoping, keep preparing. Hope, not just in the ethereal sense of like, oh, I live in hope, but like hope in action looks like preparation. I'm preparing for that opportunity when that person does cross my path, and then we call it luck, we call it magic, we call it a meet cute, whatever. But I wouldn't, that opportunity would have passed me by if I was not prepared. And that's then what happened. So I always like to like, live in hope.
I love that. I love that so much. Be prepared for luck with preparation. Yes. All right. Yes. Well, thank you again for joining, and we'll link to your socials and people can find you and your book.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. This was a fun conversation.
Absolutely. Bye for now.